If you'll take out your Bibles and turn to the book of Job, we're going to be spending most of our time there this afternoon. I've been given the coveted post-lunch slot, and so I'm going to do my best to be awake and alert, and please do your best as well, and hopefully we'll get a lot out of this study. We're going to do a super quick overview of the book of Job, because if you're anything like me, before you've studied the book really, Job is one of those books where it's like, okay, chapter 1 and chapter 2, like God and Satan, like all this cool stuff behind the scenes. And then blah, 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 blah. God says some stuff, and then Job's stuff is given back. And, like, there's all this stuff in the middle of Job that it's hard. And there's, like, lots of people talking about stuff, and it seems really repetitive and cyclical. But I want us just to think real quick about an outline of the book and the nature of the book of Job, because I think it helps us learn a lot of really powerful lessons about just that we can take away. So I'm going to go ahead and put up the whole outline here, because the book of Job kind of follows a symmetrical pattern. The fancy word for that is a chiasm, but the idea is the book is structured in a way that mirrors itself. And so in the beginning, you have the prologue where Job is tested and his possessions and then his health are taken from him as God and Satan are talking about Job and whether or not he will curse God and die. In chapter 3, there's an opening lament that Job gives, lamenting the day of his birth. And then in 4 through 27, it's a debate. Job's friends were silent at the beginning, but then when they open their mouth, things kind of go downhill from there. And they're back and forth and trying to figure out really things about God and things about suffering and things about good and evil. And there's back and forth and accusations. So that's 4 through 27. In the middle of the book, Job is still speaking. But there's really this idea of a kind of a hymn to wisdom and just praising, like, everybody's looking for wisdom, which is really what's happening in this book, isn't it? It's like these guys are all like, what's God really like? What's the wisdom about God and suffering and figuring out this life? And so then the second half of the book, you got three cycles of monologue. You know, of course, dialogue, two people talking. Monologue is like one person going on and on. And Job continues to defend himself after the hymn to wisdom. And then Elihu, we'll talk more about him in just a minute, he speaks for a while, about six chapters. And then, of course, the Lord himself speaks at the end of this section. Job has his closing confession in which he says, I didn't know what I was talking about. And then the Lord reconciles Job and his friends and restores the fortunes of Job. And so when you think about Elihu for just a minute, there's a lot of debate over his role in the book. If you've ever studied Job or looked at commentaries on Job, some people are like, Elihu is terrible. Like, he's super arrogant, and he's just like the friends except worse, and he doesn't really say anything new, and like, why is he even in here? And there's some people who are like, well, Elihu is like from God, and he is a messenger from God to help prepare Job for what God is going to say. I really think there's a good case to be made for the second of those two options. That Elihu doesn't just repeat what the friends say, but he really enhances the book a whole lot. He gets through to Job where the friends didn't. One powerful argument for that is this. The way the book of Job goes is the first part of the book is the friends attacking Job and Job answering his friends. And that's kind of the back and forth of the book. And then Elihu answers Job, which, by the way, the friends, like, ultimately can't really answer Job. Like, their speeches generally kind of get shorter and shorter, and Job's speeches kind of get longer and longer. Like, Job kind of wins that argument, if you will, and Elihu's kind of mad about that. He's like, you weren't able to silence Job, friends. Like, you should have been able to do that. So Elihu answers Job, and then Job is given the opportunity to respond to Elihu, but Job is silent, which I think is interesting. Elihu even says at one point in there, like, hey, if you've got anything to correct me, like, say it. And Job doesn't say anything. And then God, of course, answers Job and puts Job in his place. But one of the interesting things about this, oh, and by the way, when God answers Job, Job repents. But the thing about this is, in this kind of picture of Job, no one answers God, of course, because it's God. But nobody answers Elihu either. We kind of have a built-in critique of the friends. Job critiques the friends. Elihu critiques Job and the friends. God critiques Job, but nobody critiques God, and nobody critiques Elihu in the book. So I think it's a fairly strong case as far as it goes. The way Elihu is presented in the book, there's nothing in the text that is telling us, like, Elihu is wrong or is just saying the same things. So for our purposes this afternoon, we can debate that later if you'd like to talk about that. I'd love to hear different perspectives, if you have a different perspective on Elihu, but we're at least, for the purposes of this lesson, we're going to look at Elihu in a positive light and view the things that he has to say as being kind of a preparation for what God has to say to Job. That Elihu basically gets through to Job on a level he can understand and answers some of Job's questions, at least to some extent. And God doesn't step down to Job to answer his questions, he just puts Job in his place and humbles him. So, what we're going to think about is five different lessons that we can learn from Job, and each of these we could say a whole lot more about. We're just going to try to touch on some practical applications. When we look at the book of Job, what Job went through, we're going to look at the power of the tongue, because really, this whole book, when you look at it, it's people talking. Like, that's really what the book of Job is. It's this long conversation. We're going to talk about the danger of overreacting, which I think is one of the big themes in the book of what happens with Job and with the friends. We're going to talk about the fact that suffering is not an excuse to speak bad about God or to sin. We're going to talk a little bit about God and Satan, and then there's the goodness of the Lord as we wrap up. So we're going to talk about the power of the tongue, because again, this book is just revolves around the idea of dialogue and talking. Let's turn to Job chapter 2, and we'll begin there. Of course, when Job's friends hear about his suffering and about the terrible calamity that has happened to him with the loss of his children, the loss of his possessions, they come from apparently quite a ways away to comfort Job. And the first thing that they do in the book turns out to be the best thing that they do in the book, looking at it. So Job chapter 2, beginning in verse 11, it says, "Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamathite, and they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and comfort him. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe, and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great." I don't know if you have ever been and visited somebody in the hospital, or you've been around somebody who's just been through something incredibly tragic. And what's like the thing that you think about, that you're kind of worried about, is like, okay, like, I'm going to go to them, and what am I going to say? Like, how do I comfort? How do I reach out to them? And I think, in talking with a few people who've been through just really tragic things, don't worry so much about that part. I think what Job's friends do here is the thing that they needed to do. They wept, and they sat with Job in silence. There's a power to silence that I don't think our culture appreciates very much. We try to kind of keep the noise going as much as possible. We seek distraction. But what Job's friends do is they're there for him. And they sit with him for a week and just are there, seeing what he's going through and being there to support him. I think it's a powerful lesson for us to think about our own suffering, but as we also think about trying to comfort others in their suffering. You remember Jesus on the night that he was betrayed and the night that he was going to start going through all these trials and ultimately his death. What did he ask the disciples to do? He said, "I want you guys to just come up with some really encouraging words. I need you to tell me what I need to hear." And, you know, and of course, not you're going to tell Jesus what he needs to hear, but he just says, "Watch with me and pray." And of course, they even have a hard time doing that. But so many times, that's what we really need. We simply need someone to be with us, to watch with us, and to pray. And that's what Jesus needed in his hour of trial. And it's what others need as well. One of the things that I think is important to see about the book of Job is the importance of listening. Because, of course, what ends up happening is the friends assume that they know what's going on, and so they start telling Job what they think he needs to hear. And Job keeps answering them and keeps telling them, "No, you're wrong about me. Really, you're wrong. Like, you're not listening. You're not. You don't know what you think you know." And the friends don't listen to Job. But look at Elihu in Job chapter 33. verses 31 through 33. I think this is one of the differences between Elihu and the friends, is Elihu responds to what he does see in Job. And of course, Job has been talking for quite a while at this point, but Elihu has been listening. Job 33, starting in verse 31, he says, "Pay attention, O Job, listen to me, keep silent, let me speak. Then if you have anything to say, answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify you. If not, listen to me. Keep silent, and I will teach you wisdom." So, at the beginning of Elihu's speech, he's already said, like, I've been silent this whole time. I've just been listening. You guys are older. I've let you guys kind of duke it out, and it hasn't been settled, so now I'm going to speak. But here, Elihu says, listen, I'm not in this just to vilify Job. I'm not in this just to justify myself. If you have something to say, I will listen to you. And if you don't have anything to say, please be quiet and listen to me. And isn't that just what we need so much right now? Especially in our culture, in our dialogue. When I get on Facebook and like I see like what all is going on right now, a failure to listen is really a source of a lot of the social problems that are happening right now. It's a lot easier to put a meme on somebody and to say, this is what those people are like over there, and they're the enemy, and they're saying, hey, no, we're not. And they're saying, yes, you are. But there's no like listening going on. One of the lessons we need to learn from Job is that's kind of what happened, is they had kind of had a meme in their minds for Job, if I can use that word, like, but a caricature of like, Job, you're the wicked guy that God punishes, and that's who you are, and no matter what you say, we know who you are. And Job is saying, you guys are wrong about this, I'm innocent, and so God must be wrong. And Job is saying, you're wrong, and God's wrong. And again, we'll talk more about that principle in a minute, but if people would just close their mouths and listen, it's not going to solve everything immediately, but it'll take us a big step in the right direction, won't it? Instead of assuming we know, just listen. And of course, what happens is the friends just start speaking past each other. They don't actually talk to what they understand. They set up something and then they're like talking at each other. In Job 16, verses 1 through 5, there's several passages like this, but Job kind of puts it in these words. Job answered, "I've heard many such things. Sorry comforters are you all. Is there no limit to windy words? Or what plagues you that you answer? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips could lessen your pain." And so Job is just saying, like, you guys are just talking at me. Like, you're not even listening. You're not comforting me at all, by the way. Sorry, comforters. One of the things that is also true about Job, at the beginning of the book, it says that Job, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips, nor did he blame God. I think that's true of chapters 1 and 2. I think by the end of the book, Job has sinned with his lips. Because when God shows up and says, Job, who do you think you are? What does Job do? Chapter 42, verses 1 through 3. Listen to what Job says after the Lord confronts him. "Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know." Job's basic confession at the end of the book is, I was speaking, or I had no business talking. My mouth is running, and I did not know what I was talking about. And that's something that we need to take to heart. When we're talking about God, and we're talking about suffering and these different things, we need to just be very careful that we don't overstep our bounds. Because I think Job ends up doing that, and seeing that the Lord shows him, hey, you have no idea what you're talking about. And we need to be very careful to be humble in the way that we speak. And we need to speak boldly where we know what's true. But we need to be very careful about speaking what we don't really understand. And of course, one of the most powerful parts of the book is when the Lord Himself speaks and we need to be silent and listen. In Job 38, at the beginning of the Lord's speech, where the Lord answers Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurement, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? There are times when we, like Job, need to be just reminded of who we are, and then we just need to be really careful with how we talk about God and who He is. And be very careful with His name and with His reputation. The tongue is powerful, and that's really one of the main instruments that's used in the book of Job. As we think about the debate of the friends, there's just so much we can learn right now and so many applications of this, but there's a danger in overreacting. And one of the things about this is, in Job chapter 8, there's an interesting statement here that Bildad says that it's easy for us in a debate or whatever to kind of rely on just what we've been taught, what our fathers before us have believed and have said. Listen to what Bildad says in Job chapter 8, 8 through 10. He says, "Please inquire of past generations and consider the things searched out by our fathers. For we are only of yesterday and know nothing, because our days on earth are as a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and bring forth words from their minds?" And Bildad is essentially appealing here and saying, we know what we're talking about because we've got history on our side. Like, the ancestors, our fathers said this. They're the ones that really know. And he's not so much appealing to wisdom from God, but just saying, well, I'm right because this is the way we've perceived things to be. That God punishes good people, or God punishes wicked people, God rewards good people. And that's kind of the overly simplistic view that the friends have. And they're basing that on the wrong kind of things. And so we need to be really careful about relying on those before us as well. Job will ultimately answer this in saying that, listen, wisdom is from God. The people who came before, they could be right, they could be wrong. There is something important, and Proverbs talks about this, in listening to those who are older and wiser, but they're not necessarily the ones that are right. And by the way, look at this passage in Job 32, 6 to 10. And see, this is Elihu speaking here. One of the things he says at the beginning of his speech, listen to what he says, Job 32, 6. "So Elihu, the son of Barakel the Buzite, spoke out and said, 'I am young in years and you are old. Therefore I was shy and afraid to tell you what I think. I thought age should speak and increased years should teach wisdom. But it is a spirit in man, and the breath of the Almighty gives them understanding. The abundant in years may not be wise, nor may elders understand justice. So I say, listen to me. I too will tell what I think.'" Elihu points out an important thing. Don't rely just on what the elders are saying, but rely on what the breath of the Almighty gives. And so what really happens in the book of Job that I think is still such a danger right now is the friends think they know, all right, this is the way God works. You're suffering, so what does that mean about you? All suffering must come from some wickedness, some terrible thing that you've done, and you look like a righteous man, so you must be hiding it, you know. And they think they know, and so they press this on Job, and they're saying, "Job, you're wicked, we know you're wicked, we don't know what it is, and actually, we have a pretty good idea, we think we know what it is. You've been oppressing the poor, you've been doing all these things," and that kind of escalates as they go back and forth. And Job is saying, "No, I'm innocent, I didn't do anything wrong. I don't know why God is doing this. God, why are you doing this? What's going on?" And what happens is because neither one is listening to the other, and because they're just talking past each other, they're kind of driven to opposite extremes. And the friends become more and more convinced that wickedness means suffering. And if you're suffering, it means you're wicked. And they just end up at the end of the cycles of the first cycles of speeches, they're just like even stronger on this side. And Job has been confused about God from the beginning. Like, I don't understand why this is happening. But with the friends going back and forth and saying, God is just, God, you know, punishes the wicked, and so you must be wicked, and all this. He's listening to that, but it kind of drives Job to the other extreme of saying, I know I'm righteous, and so God must be wrong. And he starts to blame God and say that God has basically perverted justice. Look at Job 24 for just a second. 24. And we won't read this whole thing, but just basically, he says, "Why are times not stored up by the Almighty? And why do those who know Him not see His days?" And then he talks about all of these terrible things that people do, and basically that verse 12, he says, from the city men groan and souls of the wounded cry out, yet God does not pay attention to folly. Basically, God doesn't care. However wicked people get, God doesn't care about that. And of course, that's Job speaking wrongly here. And Job, a little bit later in verses 21 through 25 of this chapter, he says, he wrongs the barren woman and does no good for the widow, but he drags off the valiant by his power. He rises, but no one has assurance of life. He provides them with security, and they are supported, and his eyes are on their ways. They're exalted a little while, and then they are gone. Moreover, they are brought low like everything gathered up, even like the heads of grain, they are cut off. Now, if it is not so, who can prove me a liar and make my speech worthless? And so basically Job is saying, these wicked, wicked people, God doesn't do anything about it. God doesn't bring them down. So again, Job has been driven to this extreme, in part, it's still Job's fault, but in part because he's overreacting to what the friends have been saying. And of course, Elihu in this corrects and says, God will not do wrong, nor does it in the Almighty to pervert justice. He sets Job straight, that God is always just. Again, one of the things that we've already mentioned is that the friends assume the motives of those who they think are in the wrong. And think that we already know, Job, what you've done, and they even start to name the different sins and those things. And isn't that easy to do when you disagree with somebody? Just kind of assume, well, they must have some ulterior motive, they must think that it's this way. And even sometimes with people that we disagree with spiritually about things that the Bible talks about, even though, like, maybe they are wrong about what the Bible says, we don't know why they think that. And we don't know, if presented with the truth, that they might change their minds on that. And we need to be really careful. I struggle with this sometimes, is in just assuming we know kind of a person's character and a person's mentality, and kind of ready to jump down their throat because you don't care about the Bible, or you don't think this is really, and like, wow, like, we don't know that. We can't assume the motives of those in the wrong. That's the problem that Job and the friends have with each other, is they're assuming instead of listening. And of course, what Elihu does, if you just look at Job 33, 34, and 35, we won't read all this afternoon, but what's really cool about Elihu's speeches is, like, he quotes from Job and says, Job, you said these things. And then he responds to it. And says, Job, here's what you said, and here's why it's wrong. Job, here's what you said, and here's why it's wrong. Here's what you said, and here's why it's wrong. And so he's been listening, and then he's not caricaturing Job's position. He's saying, here's your words, and now here's the truth about that. Here's wisdom from God about that. And we just think about this whole idea of overreacting. Man, you see it all the time spiritually, don't we? Is like there might be something that's wrong and erroneous. I mean, even take things, for instance, like in some doctrines of Calvinism that talk about, you know, that we're totally depraved and that God is completely sovereign, but taking that in a sense of like nothing happens except that like God makes everybody do this. But then in overreacting to that, sometimes we think kind of it's works-based, like it has to be us and it's all me and my effort and it's not God. And of course, the other thing is true, and in some ways Calvinism was an overreaction to Catholicism and the very works-based, you can buy indulgences and stuff like that. And a lot of religious history is just kind of the pendulum swinging from one extreme to the other, and people saying, that's wrong, we shouldn't believe that, so we're going to run as far in the other direction as we can. And that's not the way you find truth. We need to identify error. But the main thing about truth is, like, find truth and hold to that truth. And if there's something that's wrong, we'll separate that out. But don't overreact and run in the other direction. I think of the people that I've seen fall away, a lot of them have fallen prey to this overreaction. Is they've seen things that they see in the church that are wrong and that should be addressed, but instead of staying and helping, they're just like, we're going to get as far away from that as I possibly can. So don't overreact. Learn the lessons of wisdom from the book of Job. Wow, that came up all at once. All right, well, I guess we will just let that come up all at once. Give away the rest of my slides. So, suffering is not an excuse. And isn't this one of the most common things that you find when you start to talk with people and they're living a life they know they shouldn't live, but you talk with them like, well, you just don't understand my life. You don't understand where I'm coming from. You don't understand what I've been through. And look at my life and look how hard it is and look at my upbringing and it's not fair and all this stuff and it's so easy. And some of those things, as far as their situation, that might really be true. People suffer. People start off with tremendous disadvantages in this life. But one of the things I think we see taught in the book of Job is that all that suffering, the suffering that Job went through at the beginning was legitimate and was terrible. Hard to imagine what Job went through. But Job is not off the hook when God shows up. And God doesn't show up and say, Job, you've been through so much, and it hasn't really been fair to you. I haven't explained myself. I am so sorry, Job. You know, I know you said some things about me that weren't true, and you really flew off the handle there for a little bit. But you know what? You went through some hard things. And I'm like, it's all okay. That's not what God says to Job. God shows up, and he corrects Job. And of course, like we just read in Job 38, he says, who is this that darkens counsel with words without knowledge? Job suffered, but Job still needed to be corrected. And that's what the Lord gave to Job. And we need to be really careful, because sometimes it's easy for us to make excuses for ourselves, isn't it? It's like, man, like, I've been through this really hard thing, and so I'm in this really hard position, you know? Like, I don't have a lot of other young people around me, or like, my family is really hard on me about spiritual things, and like, I can't be as strong as you because I'm in a harder spot than you, you know? I mean, and so like, I'm trying to do better, but I'm like, you know. And again, we just try to make these excuses. And think about for a minute if that was really true. If suffering was a legitimate excuse. Think about the example of Joseph for just a minute. Here in Genesis 39. If Joseph is there and Potiphar's wife is like, come, lie with me. And Joseph is like, you know, man, I'm here sold into slavery by my brothers. I got nobody around me who even maybe even knows about Jehovah, let alone cares enough to serve him. I mean, I've had a really hard life. I can just go ahead and give in this once and like, I'll be forgiven for that, right? You know? And of course, giving in to sin doesn't mean that just this once. It takes you farther than you want to go, like we've been talking about. But what if that was the case? What's so inspiring to us about Joseph? He didn't make excuses. He said, how can I do this great evil and sin against God? It doesn't matter how hard it is for me right now. That's not an excuse. That's really hard. I mean, it's easy for us to say that in the comfort of this building, but man, when things get hard, isn't that the thing we try to do, is like our minds start to try to latch on to, well, maybe in this situation, like I can go ahead and sin and like it'll be okay because... No. Suffering's not an excuse. The thing about the people in the Bible is they were the victim a lot of times, but they didn't play the victim card. You know? And so many times, that's the thing. Our culture especially right now. And of course, this is no excuse for what Job says about God. We just read these verses a second ago with basically Job saying, God sees evil and he doesn't care. He doesn't do anything about it. And that's just not true. We can't speak evil of God just because we're going through something hard. But the beautiful thing about this is that God sees this in Job, and God could have just destroyed Job. The end of the book of Job could have been, God shows up and says, who is this that darkens counsel without knowledge? And like, that was it. But God has mercy on Job. Job repents of what he did, of what he said. And God forgave him. I think it's really encouraging for us to see that even if there have been times in our life where we've been using suffering as an excuse or as a crutch, God can forgive us of that and help us out of that to really serve him. One of the biggest themes in the book of Job is just the picture of God and Satan and the things that we learn about them and the way that they work in the book of Job. It's really, in some ways, we see some clearer pictures in Job than we do in almost anywhere else in the Bible about who God is and who Satan is. But one of the main things about the book of Job that we learn is that when we're suffering, what's like the question that people keep asking in that situation? It's like, why? Why is this happening? And really, that goes back to, does God care? Does God really care about me and about my life and about my family? Because it looks to me like because of what I'm going through, God wouldn't let this happen if he cared. And so really one of the main things in discussion in the book of Job is the character of God. Does God really care? And one of the things that we see emphasized over and over again in the book of Job is that God does care about you. And you might be going through something incredibly difficult, but God still cares. At the beginning of the book of Job, of course, God blessed Job with everything that he had at the beginning. It begins with a description of Job's riches, doesn't it? And all the different livestock and the riches and things that he had, his big family. God cared about Job then. God wanted Job to serve him then, and he was. He was making sacrifices for his kids. He was doing his best to make sure that they were being raised in the right way. And at the end of the book of Job, when Job's fortunes are restored and things are going well with Job, God cares when we're doing well. And by the way, that also means, because sometimes when we're doing well, sometimes that's another temptation for us to think that God doesn't really care what I do, because obviously He approves of me because things are going great. And God still cares about right and wrong when life is great. Job could have relied on his wealth and his riches and gotten really proud and arrogant and said, I don't need the Lord. I don't need to offer sacrifices for my kids. God obviously loves me and cares about me, so like, don't worry about it. And that's not what Job does. But of course, the opposite end of the spectrum is that God cares when we have nothing left. One of the things I think is amazing to see, turn back to Job chapter 2 for just a second. After the first round of trial, when Satan is allowed to take away Job's family, his kids, his possessions, his wealth, when Satan comes to the Lord again, look at chapter 2, verse 3. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. Job is suffering, and Job is going through all these things, but God sees that, and He appreciates that, and He puts Job on display at the beginning of this book. Even after Job is suffering and saying, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord, God sees what's happening there. And He doesn't apparently express this to Job in words, but we need to remember that when we're suffering as righteous people, God cares. And He sees and He knows. And again, we're not perfect people, but if we're holding up under persecution, we can imagine God saying, have you considered my servant so-and-so? We need to keep holding fast because God cares. Even in those times. Of course, on the other end of things, we learn just how low Satan is. Satan cares nothing about you and nothing about your soul. And I think, like, we've just talked about a lot earlier today. And seen, Satan will just take away all dignity. He'll hit you when you're down and let you hit the consequences of your sin. And if you don't turn from that, he'll give you more and things will get worse and worse and worse. Satan just has no limits, really. And really, when God puts these things in Satan's hand and allows him to do these things to Job, Satan, I think, is the one who comes up with this stuff. Okay, I'm going to take away his riches, I'm going to take away his kids. And it may have been, again, some of this is a little bit of speculation, but it may have been that Job, or that Satan, left Job's wife and took away that, but he's like, I know that I can get through to her. And so I'm going to leave her there. And there's a really interesting thing when you compare Job and Job's wife to Adam and Eve, and you think about a situation where Satan was able to get through to the woman in order to get through to the man. And what happens in the Garden of Eden is kind of parallel to what Satan does in chapter 2, where Job's wife says, curse God and die! You know, she's already kind of given in. But Job stands where Adam fell. And directs his wife lovingly and says, you're speaking like a foolish woman. Should we accept good from God and not evil as well? Job is an incredible example of headship right there. That's really another lesson for another time. But again, Satan doesn't care. He will try to bring people to their knees and to just destroy people. And Satan is a slanderer. Really the whole premise of the book of Job is the idea of Satan. What does he say? You know, God, Job just serves you because you put a hedge around him. You've protected him. And so he slanders Job and says, Job is just serving God for what he can get out of it. And if you take away what he has, if you take away his health, he will curse you to your face. That's kind of the wager of the book of Job. And when you get to the end of the book of Job, who's wrong? Satan is wrong. Job was not perfect in the book of Job. But he never gave up on God. He never cursed God and was struck dead for that. It's interesting to me that in Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, it talks about Satan as that ancient serpent, and it talks about the slander of our brethren. And that's the idea, is that Satan is slandering us. He wants to, and sometimes we give him a lot of ammunition, that's true, but he wants to say things about people that's not true. He wants us to believe things about God that's not true. All the way back in the garden, where he said, God knows that in the day you eat this fruit, what? You'll know good and evil. And kind of, again, trying to make God out. God's withholding something from you. He's not letting you in on the secret, you know? And again, Satan is just a slanderer, and we need to combat that with God's truth. Another thing that we need to know about God is that God will allow us to be tested. One of the things that we see about the men and women of faith that we're studying this weekend, and this is something that my dad points out sometimes in his sermons, it's stuck with me over the years, is that God very often allows people of faith to face their worst fears. You think about Abraham for just a minute. But we'll talk about this later on this weekend. But what did God allow Abraham to face after the promises that he made to Abraham and the faith that Abraham showed? And he finally, in his old age, he has a son, and this is the son of promise. This is going to be the fulfillment of God's promises. What does God come to Abraham and say in Genesis 22? I want you to take everything that you've hoped for and dreamed about, and I want you to kill it and burn it on an altar to me. The amount of fear and uncertainty and just, how can this be? How can God ask me to do this? God allows Abraham to face some of his worst fears, and he brings him through that. And Abraham, of course, stands up in that test. With Job, he's a righteous man, he's a wealthy man, and he faces a test not only of losing all of his stuff, but he loses his reputation. His friends are like, you're wicked, you're a terrible person. Obviously, you don't love God because all this, and Job loses just like everything. God allows Job to go through these trials. And guys, if we live long enough, God will allow us to go through some really, really hard things. And it may be that God brings us to a place where we face our worst fears. But God works through those things. God uses those things for good to those who love Him. God allowed Job to be tested. What do we know about the tests that God gives us? In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, and in each instance of this, in Job 1, he says, all that he has is in your hand, but what? Don't lay a finger on Job. God gives Satan a realm in which to operate, but he limits Satan. And then he says, okay, you can touch his health, you can take away his health, but don't touch his life. Don't kill him. And guess what Satan has to do? Satan couldn't touch Job initially. Nothing happened to Job's health. And then he does not kill Job. Satan is limited. God is more powerful than Satan. And when God says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow what? That temptation is not too hard. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will give a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. And again, that's also what takes away our excuse, isn't it? As sometimes, oh, this is too hard, this is too much. No, God takes away that excuse. It's not going to be too hard. It might feel like it's too hard, but it's never too hard. And sometimes God knows more about us than we do. I think about when I was in high school track, one of the things that we would do, I hated this drill, but we get on the track, and what the coach would do, the coach would stand in the middle of the field with a stopwatch, basically, or with a whistle, and he would say, he would blow the whistle. And when he blows the whistle, you have to sprint around the track as fast as you can. But the thing about the drill is he doesn't tell you how far it's going to be. And so you're just like running like all out. That's not too bad, but it's like, okay, there's the finish line, 200 meters to go, 100 meters to go, okay, I'm done, you know. But when it's just like, I'm just running as hard as I can, and I don't know how long it's going to be hard, you know. And then when you blew the whistle again, we do what we call shuffling, where like, it's kind of like the feeble jog, where like, you might as well be walking, but you have to keep like moving. And so it was like, sprint, and then you shuffle. You sprint, and you shuffle. And you didn't know how long the sprint was going to be, and you didn't know how long the shuffle was going to be. You might have like a couple minutes to get some rest, and you might have like 20 seconds. But one of the things about that, because when we think about the Christian life as a race and God testing us and training us, is the coach many times in those situations knew that like you could push yourself harder than you think. And so he'd let you run hard for longer. And you didn't know how long that test was going to be. And then he would give a time of rest. And he kind of knew how much rest you would need. And sometimes you'd like more rest, but he says, nope, time to go again. And that was the drill. And in some ways, that's a good analogy for God testing us and helping us in our life. And we just have to trust our coach, you know? God has the whistle in his hand. He knows when we need to be tested, and he knows when we need rest and the perfect balance of all of those things. And we've got to learn to trust him. And of course, the end of all of this, and we've already mentioned this, is that Satan is always defeated by God. Satan is proved to be a liar at the end of the book of Job. It's interesting that it's not like an epilogue where we see Satan and all those things, but God could have come up to Satan at the end and said, "You liar! Job never cursed me. I took away his stuff, I took away his health, and Job held to me, even when he did not get it, even when he thought I was unrighteous, and he thought all kinds of crazy things about me, but he never turned his back like you said he would." And brethren, may we be those people who prove Satan to be a liar by the grace of God and hold fast to him even in the most difficult of situations. And so, of course, the question for us is, who are we going to follow? The world gives the illusion that it's like, oh, you got all these rules, but then you can be really free. But really, the reality of it is we're slaves to God or we're slaves to sin and Satan. And which of these two do you really want to serve? One more thing to think about. Turn to the book of James for just a second, because this is really it's interesting to me sometimes, after all the stuff you study about the patriarchs in the Old Testament, to see some of the brief statements that are made in the New Testament. Kind of like with Lot, like, I think that statement about him being a righteous man like helps us kind of see the picture in the Old Testament more clearly. And here, this is an interesting statement about Job and his struggles. In James chapter 5, after he's talking about endurance and the farmer waiting and all these things, he says this: "We count those blessed who endured. You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful." And I think the ESV says, "You've seen the goodness of the Lord." And really, hasn't that been like the main question of the book of Job, back and forth and round and about? Is God good? Is God good? And what does that mean for us? And he's saying to these readers, you've heard of Job. Maybe you've read the book. And the thing that's proved true at the end of that book is that the Lord is good. The Lord is compassionate and merciful. And you think about this. One of the most important lessons, I think, one of the main things that God says near the end of the book of Job, turn back to Job chapter 41 for a second, is just, we get this idea sometimes in our head that we're pretty good, and if we try to kind of live a good life and we're not like being as bad as some of those other people, then God kind of owes it to me to give me good things. And it's really easy how subtly that can slip into our thinking sometimes, so that when bad things happen, we're like, God, why? Like, this shouldn't be happening to me. I'm trying to be a good guy. But the thing that the book of Job, and particularly God's answer in the book of Job, reminds us of, is that God doesn't owe you anything. In Job 41, after he's described Leviathan, one of the points that he makes after these amazing creatures, and like God made all of this stuff and made us, Job 41, starting in verse 10, he says, "No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me? who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. And we need to get this lesson through our heads. That God owes us nothing. He took some dust off of the earth that He made and He breathed on it. And it became a man. And we're a descendant of dust. Like, we're nothing. And it's really, in suffering, that's when we're tempted to think of ourselves as something more than that. As like, this isn't fair. It's not, this shouldn't be happening to me because I have some, like, goodness that, like, this shouldn't be happening to. And it's like, when you really look at it, we have no rights. We have no clout. We have nothing except that, well, God made me, and God put me here, and it's up to Him, really. Any good thing that I receive is God's mercy. I have done nothing to merit His blessings. I've done nothing to deserve His mercy. Any good thing I have is because God is patient with me. And what's amazing to me is that this has abundant implications. This verse right here is quoted at like the climax of the book of Romans. In Romans chapter 11, verse 35, after he's gotten to the end of this treatise on salvation by faith and not by works, this dovetails well with what J.D. was saying about Abraham and Abraham's faith, is that you're not saved by your works. You can't earn it. You are dust. You've sinned. You're sinful dust at that. And he gets to the end of the book of Romans saying God gets to choose who is saved, and He's chosen His people of faith. But at the end of all this, he just bursts out into this blessing. Oh, the depth of the riches of both the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments and unfathomable His ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who became His counselor? And then he quotes from the book of Job. And he says, or who has first given to Him that it might be paid back to Him again? For from Him and through Him and to Him are all things. To Him be the glory forever. Amen. And that's really one of the fundamental lessons we have to learn in suffering and in theology. When we're thinking about like right and wrong and how do we understand how we're saved, it's like, God doesn't owe me anything. I can't give God anything that He hasn't first already given to me. It's not like, you know, like on Sunday when the collection plate is going around, if y'all do the collection plate some places, and like there's like the little kid, you know, that you know, the parents, they put like the quarter in the collection plate or whatever. But like what happened like a couple minutes right before that, right, is the parents were like, okay, like here, like you put this in the plate when it comes around. I mean, then there's something to be said for that, for like, you know, training your children to be giving, and that's a really good thing. But here's the thing, like when it comes to giving to God, like we're all that little kid. Like anything that we put in the plate, so to speak, God gave it to us like 5 minutes before, you know. Like that's us. God doesn't owe us anything. Anything we give back. You know, who can give to God? And so, again, this has abundant implications across the board. When we think about just everything being a gift of God's goodness, He gives in His grace and gives again. I just made this list, and I might encourage you to make your own list like this, is thinking about the blessings of God in the book of Job. God blessed Job with all he had at the beginning of the book. That's one thing that's important to remember, is we could look at Job at the beginning and say, Job was righteous and Job was blessed. The end. It's like, but the thing is, Job didn't deserve the blessings at the beginning. That was God's grace and mercy that blessed him in the first place. God blessed Job by limiting Satan in both of the trials. God blessed Job by trusting him with the trials that he gave him. Satan was slandering Job and God by saying these things. And so God blessed him by entrusting Job with what he went through. God blessed Job, I think, by sending Elihu to get through to Job in a way that he could understand before God kind of brings the hammer down and puts Job in his place. God blessed Job by humbling him when the trials revealed his pride. And you think about that. Again, kind of like Judah or some of these other people, is when we go through tough stuff, thank God when it wakes us up. God blessed Job by moving him to repent of his sins. When we're moved to godly sorrow, when our life is hard and it moves us to repent, that's God's mercy. God blessed Job by helping him to forgive his friends and pray for them. I think it's amazing the reconciliation of those relationships that happens. How hard would that have been for Job to pray for the friends who've been ridiculing him and slandering him this whole time? And yet God helps those relationships to be mended. God blessed Job by giving him more undeserved blessings after he sinned. The blessings at the beginning of the book were God's mercy, and the blessings at the end of the book was double mercy. Job earned none of those things through the book. And I think Job probably would have viewed the blessings at the end of the book in a different light than at the beginning of the book. One of the wonderful things about Job is that with all that he goes through, even in his doubt and in his railing against God, Job is, I think, stronger and closer to God at the end of the book than he is at the beginning. What is it that Job says? I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees. And whatever it is that draws us closer to God, that can be a blessing to us. And so, of course, the question for us, how will I choose to view God? The Lord is given, the Lord is taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Thank you for your attention.